Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story provides fresh perspective on the stories that matter with me, Katia Adler, and the BBC's worldwide network of journalists and reporters. Coming soon from the BBC World Service. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday, the 23rd of November, these are our main stories. Freedom delayed. Israeli hostages in Gaza will have to wait at least another day to be released. The Ukrainian children illegally taken and adopted by Russians, including a key Putin ally, will bring you a special report. We're in the Netherlands after the far-right anti-Islamist politician surprises everyone with his electoral triumph. Also in this podcast, a new breeding ground for these. Big, beautiful blue whales. People in Gaza thought they would be experiencing a lull in the conflict at the moment, a four-day truce. And we had been hoping to tell you that the first of many hostages in Gaza were now free. But the Israeli military says its forces remain in a continued state of combat in Gaza. It says it's hit 300 targets there in overnight bombardments. Meanwhile, the IDF has confirmed that the director of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza has been detained. A senior doctor from Al-Shifa said that the director, Abu Salamia, was arrested while accompanying patients who were evacuated from the hospital. I spoke to our correspondent, Yolande Nell.
First of all, even as a truce has been discussed, we can see that the fighting is very intense in Gaza. Clouds of black smoke rising up, deadly Israeli airstrikes reported, particularly in the north of the Gaza Strip, also in the southern city of Khan Yunis. That's, of course, in the area that people were told to evacuate to for their own safety. The Israeli military said that it hit 300 Hamas targets in the past 24 hours. Meanwhile, I've just seen sirens have been sounding again, in southern Israel. That usually warns of incoming Palestinian rocket fire. And at the same time, yes, hospitals do remain a main focus of what's going on. A day after Israel's military showed journalists this well-built tunnel at a Shifa hospital, which it says was used by Hamas fighters hiding there behind civilians as a human shield. Now Israel has confirmed that it's arrested the hospital director and other staff there. And all of this, you know, as of course Israel and Hamas, both sides are continuing to accuse each other of war crimes at this site. When it comes to the Indonesian hospital, the director there up in the north of the Gaza Strip tells us that they have been told by the Israeli military they have to evacuate. He's told us at the BBC he's one of only 10 medics still there, but they have 200 wounded people and say they won't leave until they can take them. He said it's a very difficult situation with fighting going on nearby, very heavy firing near the hospital.
Let's look at the problems with the planned truce now. Qatari mediators say they're working towards finalising a pause to come into force on Friday. They say the delay has been caused by paperwork rather than disagreements. Gershon Baskin is a former Israeli hostage negotiator. He gave us this assessment.
It's a complicated negotiating situation where the people who are the decision makers are in fact underground and without digital communication. So I'm assuming that the delay is simply because of technical details that need to be decided by the people underground, maybe problems in locating all the hostages that they're planning to release because they're spread out across the Gaza Strip, probably in tunnels and in basements of homes. And I hope that it's not something more complex than that, that would foil the dealing completely. But I think it's in the interest of both sides of Israel and Hamas to make sure that this deal happens.
An Israeli government source told the BBC that there are hopes the framework for a deal between Hamas and Israel will begin on Friday. All the while there's fighting, aid agencies can't bring in help, food, water and fuel. Imogen Folks reports from Geneva now, where many UN agencies are based.
It's as ever superficially calm and quiet here in Geneva, but behind the scenes there's frantic activity as UN aid agencies prepare for what they hope will be a sustained truce. They've been begging for access to Gaza for weeks now. They've got truckloads of aid supplies backed up at the border. The needs, they say, are immense. 1.7 million people displaced, 770,000 of them crammed into UN schools being used as shelters. UNICEF has told us that 700 people are sharing one shower. There's one toilet per 150 people. Healthcare is on the verge of collapse, particularly in northern Gaza. Just two of 24 hospitals are still functioning. Many, many, over 100 UN staff have been killed in the fighting, as well as doctors from the medical charity MSF. But what's not clear yet is exactly what and how much aid will be allowed in. Fuel is a big question. The Israelis are very cautious. They fear that Hamas could use it for its fight rather than for hospitals and water pumping stations. And what about aid workers to go along with the supplies? The WHO has surgical teams standing by, but it's not clear yet whether they will be allowed to go in. Now, what everybody, though, is agreed on here in Geneva is that any relief that can be brought to families in both Israel and Gaza is welcome. Every bit of aid will help, but even everything that goes in is unlikely to be enough.
Imogen Folks there. Well, the war in Ukraine has been filled with horrors and abuses, of course, from the killings and rapes of Ukrainian civilians in towns north of Kyiv in the first few weeks of the war, to the seemingly indiscriminate shelling of residential areas in Ukrainian cities close to the front line now. And now, another disturbing discovery in the conflict involving stolen children, a secret adoption and a key ally of Vladimir Putin. Ukraine says Russia has abducted around 20,000 children since the invasion began in 2022. Russia disputes this figure. Well, the BBC has investigated what happened to more than 40 children who were taken from a children's home in Kherson last year, and one child in particular. Hilary Anderson reports.
As Russian troops battled to keep control of Kherson last year, a group of more than 40 Ukrainian children played together in a basement. These were children from the Kherson Regional Children's Home. Some were orphans, some had special medical needs, others had parents who couldn't look after them. There were persistent reports in the city that the Russians were taking Ukrainian children.
Here we have the children's artwork.
Dr. Natalia Lutikova, who cared for children at the nearby local hospital, was worried.
Here we had wards for children from the children's home.
One of her patients was a 10-month-old girl called Margarita, who had bronchitis. Margarita's mother had given up custody soon after she was born. Last August, a mysterious Russian visitor came to the hospital. She introduced herself as an official from Moscow and asked to inspect the children on Margarita's ward. Shortly after, Margarita was sent back to the children's home. Then, armed Russian men came in a car and took her away. 7 weeks later, the remaining 46 children in the children's home were taken. Naming the children one by one, Russian officials loaded them onto buses and ambulances to take them deeper into Russian-controlled territory. A Russian member of parliament appeared to orchestrate the operation and said it was a humanitarian mission. The Russians filmed the whole event. A Ukrainian freelance investigator, Victoria Novikova, has been working with the BBC to try to find out what happened to the Kherson children.
The Kherson children's home was ripped apart by the Russians. They took the children away in different directions. Absolutely brazen abductions.
Victoria began to look for Margarita. The first question, who was the woman who'd visited Margarita in the hospital ward? Victoria showed a photo of Russian officials visiting Kherson that month to Dr. Lutikova, who pointed to a woman in a lilac dress.
This woman, dressed in lilac, was introduced as the head of children's affairs. They were escorted by three armed soldiers. She was the one who paid attention to Margarita.
We uncovered documents that reveal the woman's identity. Her name is Ina Varlamova. She works for the Russian parliament in an unknown role. Later, we got hold of documents and train bookings. Ina Varlamova had arrived in occupied Ukraine the day Margarita was taken, and she returned to Moscow that same night. Then, a breakthrough. We found marriage and birth records. Weeks after Margarita was taken, Varlamova married a major Russian politician. The couple have a child called Marina. Marina's birthday was listed as October 31st, 2021, the same day Margarita was born.
Victory will be ours. Russia will prevail. Russia will be great.
Sergei Mironov, Varlamova's husband, is an ally of President Putin, who strongly supports the war in Ukraine. The adoption record shows that he and his wife adopted Margarita. Her name was changed to Marina and her place of birth to Russia. Under international law, removing a child from their home country with no intention of giving them back is a war crime. The Russian government says it's unaware of the case and can't comment. Mironov and Varlamova didn't respond to requests for comment.
Hilary Anderson with that report for BBC Panorama. The World Health Organization has asked China for more information about an outbreak of pneumonia in the north of the country that appears to be mostly affecting children. The Chinese authorities admitted last month that the country was experiencing an increase in respiratory illnesses. From Beijing, our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports.
China's National Health Commission has attributed a spike in flu-like illnesses this winter to the lifting of COVID-19 measures. But in recent weeks, reports in non-state media claimed that children's hospitals in Beijing and other parts of China were overwhelmed with sick children. ProMed, which monitors human and animal disease outbreaks worldwide, has also issued a notification detailing a reported epidemic of undiagnosed pneumonia in children. Other countries, including the UK and the US, saw similar surges in flu-like illnesses once pandemic restrictions were lifted. The WHO said it was unclear whether the outbreak and the overall increase in respiratory infections previously reported by the authorities in Beijing were linked and has asked for more detailed information.
Laura Bicker. The largest animals on Earth are now making their home in a part of the Indian Ocean where they were wiped out by whaling ships decades ago. Researchers working around the Seychelles had already caught a glimpse of a few individual blue whales in 2020 and 2021, but an entire year of underwater audio recordings has now revealed these weren't just chance encounters. Our science correspondent Victoria Gill has been listening in.
The blue whale is the largest animal to ever exist on the planet, and their sounds are very low frequency. Just knowing that there is a population out there around the Seychelles is incredibly exciting.
Dr. Kate Stafford from Oregon State University was the lead researcher on this recent Indian Ocean expedition. Scientists and wildlife filmmakers set out together to discover whether blue whales had returned to the waters around the Seychelles.
In the 1960s, Soviet whalers found about 500 blue whales just to the north of the Seychelles and killed them all. And so part of the impetus was to see, do blue whales still occur around the Seychelles?
All right, here you go.
Okay.
To work out if a population had become re-established here, they fixed underwater microphones to the seabed.
We had divers put this down and leave it for a year. You can listen underwater 24 hours a day, and you're also listening to undisturbed animals.
At this moment, got everything ready, and then you just put your headphones on and turn the level up because you never know
what you're going to hear.
Renowned wildlife sound recordist Chris Watson was part of the film crew on the trip. He showed me how to capture sound beneath the surface.
I can hear the stones on the seabed ebb and flow with the current.
It is quite relaxing.
Sound, yeah, quite a good sound.
But even with his expert eavesdropping, Chris didn't manage to hear blue whales in the Seychelles.
We were there for a month and I was out every day listening, and not once, sadly, did he hear a blue whale.
It was Dr. Stafford's year-long fixed sound traps that revealed that the whales were there, communicating when the scientists and filmmakers had all left.
Sound travels much further and more efficiently underwater than it does in air. So low frequency sounds in particular can travel for tens to hundreds of kilometers.
Painstaking analysis of that entire year of sound picked up the telltale deep calls of blue whales.
We heard blue whale sounds roughly 6 months during the year, primarily during March and April. That suggests that the Seychelles is really important for the blue whales. Turns out if you stop killing animals on mass scales, they can recover.
This is the song of the largest animal on Earth. A clip that Chris Watson recorded on a different blue whale expedition in Mexico. Depending on what device you're listening to this on, it might be too low for your speakers.
This really low, deep, consistent pulse, this woo, 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 woo. Being out on the inky blackness of the Sea of Cortez before sunrise, looking at your hydrophone cables disappearing below the surface, but then hearing the song of the largest animal that's ever lived being drawn out of those depths was one of the most exciting things I've ever done.
That report was by Victoria Gill. Still to come on this podcast. Doctor Who at 60. We look at the timeless appeal of the travelling Time Lord.
Food is incredibly important in the world.
It's about survival,
culinary heritage,
culture and tradition,
different relationships across the world.
The Food Chain from the BBC World Service examines the business, science and cultural significance of food.
If this kind of food is lost, a community will lose its identity.
And what it takes to put food on your plate.
This is an incredible journey.
Search for The Food Chain wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
It was a victory that no one saw coming, not even the winner himself. Geert Wilders, the veteran anti-Islam populist politician, is celebrating his Freedom Party winning the most seats in the snap general election in the Netherlands. He'll now have to persuade other parties to join him in a coalition. Not an easy task. Before the vote, the three other big parties ruled out taking part in a Wilders-led government because of his controversial policies. Wilders told the BBC that he'd be willing to find compromises in order to get some partners.
Of course, we are willing to negotiate because we want to form a coalition for our voters. I believe it's approximately 2 million voters yesterday that voted for our party. And we are very willing and able, and we proved to be able to do that in the year 2010, where we showed and proved that we are able to make compromises and to take responsibility. So yes, indeed, we are willing to do that. We are eager to do that because it gives us a lot of responsibilities, this huge...
Our correspondent in The Hague, Alan Holligan, told us more about him.
He's a veteran. He's been in Parliament for more than 25 years. He lives under 24-hour security. He is a highly controversial radical politician. He has been accused of hate speech. He's anti-Islam. He wants to ban the Quran. He wants to close down all mosques. He wants to put up the borders. And yet, over the last few weeks, during the election campaign, he has come across as much more moderate. His critics call him a cuddly fascist, the way he has performed. He says, in fact, he is prepared to govern on behalf of all of the Dutch people. And when I spoke to him just after the TV debate, and he was saying then, yes, I have a Nexit, I want to take the Netherlands out of the EU, but what I want is a referendum, and I understand in Dutch society there's not a mood for that across the population. So he's really reined in on that. And I spoke to him just after he'd cast his vote here in The Hague, yes. And at that point, when I said, what would you be like as Prime Minister, he had to take a moment because I think even for him, this result is beyond his wildest dreams. And when he gave his victory speech, it looked as though he had tears in his eyes. It was a rather empty room, though, because we, all of the journalists, had it headed to the Conservative Liberal VVD party, where they are not celebrating.
Well, the strong showing for Geert Wilders and his Freedom Party does follow a wider trend in Europe, where plenty of other political parties described as far right have either taken power or have a good chance of doing so. I discuss this with our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
Well, a lot of people suggest that it's happening across the continent, certainly in large parts of it. I mean, just look who's been congratulating Geert Wilders. One of the first was the Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, shares his hostility to immigration, to Islam. And he said that this victory by Geert Wilders showed that there was a winds of change passing through Europe. Then we had the French long-term presidential candidate Marine Le Pen, similar ideology, and she said that that this victory showed that there was still hope for change in Europe. I think she might be thinking of herself there. She's hoping to become the president after the next election in France, and a lot of people think she can make it. An interesting country is Germany, next door to France, next door to Holland. And there, a lot of people always said, oh, well, the far right will never do well in Germany because of its history, because of its experience of Nazism. Well, the AfD has done very well there recently. In some parts of Germany, it's the leading party, also standing on a ticket of opposing immigration, strongly opposed to Islam. And then we've got another country with a history of fascism, and that's Italy. In fact, the Brothers of Italy party is a direct descendant of the wartime fascist party led by Mussolini. Their leader, Giorgio Meloni, has become prime minister. So that's part of a trend which many see spreading across the continent.
So why is the far right doing well at the moment?
Well, one obvious answer is immigration. All these parties are opposed to immigration, and immigration has reached record numbers, hundreds of thousands, crossing the Mediterranean or crossing by land from Turkey. And another problem, though, is that this has caused problems for the European Union, which is seen as inadequate for dealing with this by some people. And a lot of those right-wing parties are also Eurosceptic, don't like the European Union. So that has also sustained them. But I think we've got to speak about something more general. These parties are not just right-wing. They're usually described as populist, strong leaders, simple messages. Well, Nick, these are difficult times across the world. Lots of conflicts going on. People are scared about climate change, pandemics. There is an appeal in someone who says, look, vote for me. I'll stop them building mosques in your town. I'll stop those foreigners coming here and your life will be get better. Lots of people would be sceptical about whether that's a real program for government, but they'll say that it's certainly very popular with voters.
Paul Moss. The head of Indonesia's anti-corruption agency has himself been named as a suspect in a case involving extortion and kickbacks. Firly Bahuri has denied he's corrupt. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, has the details.
The police said there was enough evidence to link Mr. Firly to corruption at the country's Ministry of Agriculture. The former minister at the department has already been arrested. Officers said they'd found foreign exchange transaction documents and $500,000 in connection with the investigation into Mr. Firly, although he's not yet been arrested. Until relatively recently, Indonesia's anti-corruption agency was well respected and successful, but its potency has been undermined by changes brought in by the current president, Joko Widodo.
Mickey Bristow. When the European Space Agency cut ties with Russia because of the war in Ukraine, it delayed plans for a mission to Mars in 2022 by 6 years. Russia had been due to make a key instrument for the Mars rover, an infrared spectrometer. Now we're hearing that it will be built here in the UK instead, at Aberystwyth University in Wales. Jonathan Amos is our science correspondent, and he told us what they're building.
Infrared light is something that we can't see. The wavelengths of light are a little bit longer than what we can detect. But you can see some interesting things in rocks if you look at them with infrared light. There's certain wavelengths that will be missing as the sunlight reflects off those rocks. And that's a telltale sign for certain minerals that you might want to chase up. And in the case of this rover, it's looking to drill below the surface when it gets to Mars to see if there might be life there, either a sort of present life, but more likely past life. And so this particular instrument, ENVIS as it's called, which is Welsh for rainbow, is going to be critical in finding the right places to go drill. It's kind of leading the search, if you like, for life on Mars when it gets down to the surface.
So Wales has stepped in. It's not known for being at the forefront of the space race, but I suppose we've come a long way since it was a two-horse race between the Soviets and the US.
There's a lot of expertise at Aberystwyth University, and they've been doing quite a lot of space activity, and actually they've been quite involved in this long-running saga, which is the Rosalind Franklin rover mission. It's a European Space Agency mission, first approved way back in 2005, had various missteps, crises, funding shortfalls and all the rest of it, and the latest being the Ukraine war and having to split with Russian partners. That's why Aberystwyth is having to step in. But they've been involved in that project for quite some time, working on the main camera system, and in particular in calibrating that camera system as well, so that when it takes pictures of the rocky surface of Mars, you know, they'll have the right colours. They'll know precisely what they're looking at. But yes, more broadly, Wales is going into space. It's looking to up what it can do in terms of all sorts of missions that are going forward.
Jonathan Amos. Today marks 60 years since the very first episode of the long-running sci-fi BBC series Doctor Who. It's got a huge following worldwide, but for those who don't know it, the Doctor is a Time Lord who explores the universe in a time-travelling spaceship called the TARDIS and tries to evade his enemy, the Daleks. During its 60 years, there have been many reincarnations of the Doctor, including one as a woman. Our reporter Paul Hayes has been taking a look back at how it all began.
BBC Television, and now the first of a new series.
That's the actual original announcement into the very first episode of Doctor Who, broadcast here for the first time in 60 years. The announcer might have given it a bit more oomph if he'd known what an historic moment it was, but a more restrained mood was understandable, as the world was still reeling from the shock of the assassination of President Kennedy the day before. That event has become indelibly linked with the start of Doctor Who, creating all sorts of myths about the show starting 10 minutes late or being the first non-news programme since it happened. What is true is that the first episode was repeated before the second the following week, something the BBC Radiophonic Workshop were probably pleased about, as it gave another chance for the theme tune they'd created to make a first impression without the announcer accidentally talking all over the start. Composed by Australian Ron Grainer, it was painstakingly constructed electronically by the workshop's Delia Derbyshire.
It was a magic experience, because I couldn't see from the music how it was going to sound. And it was just Ron's brilliant oral imagination. Because when he heard the results, oh, he was really tickled pink.
It's all very interesting. Yes, that's very, 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 very interesting.
William Hartnell there, the first Doctor. The idea for Doctor Who was created by two senior members of the BBC drama department, the Canadian Sidney Newman and the Scotsman Donald Wilson. Donald Wilson may very well have named the programme, and he certainly strongly believed in its potential, writing 3 weeks before its debut that
"We have an absolute knockout in this show, and there will be no question but that it will run and run."
Although producer Verity Lambert did later remember that Wilson hadn't thought much of the scripts for the second Doctor Who story, which introduced a certain race of alien monsters.
The quality is poor.
Donald hated it. He said to us, "You can't put this out. This is terrible." So we did it, and of course it was this huge and immediate success. And to give Donald his due, when it was clear that it was a great success, he called us in and said, "Well, I obviously don't know anything about this, and you do know what you're talking about, so I won't bother to interfere again."
Now, as Doctor Who hits 60, time for a whole new beginning once again. But what might the original Doctor, William Hartnell, have made of it all? Jessica Carney wrote a biography of him, and also happens to be his granddaughter.
Gosh, well, it's a bit mind-boggling, isn't it? I think he would have been thrilled. I think he knew that they were onto a good thing, but how can anyone know what their legacy is going to be? No one will know that. I mean, he would have been thrilled that the love and care he put into the performance and the creation of the character should have borne such fruit.
It's far from being all over.
Certainly isn't. That is the very first Doctor Who. William Hartnell ending that report by Paul Hayes. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Charlotta Taljinska, and the producer was Vanessa Heaney. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.